The next big change at the Department of Defense may be in the Chief Information Officer's office, but it may not be a personnel change. It may be a change to the org chart. Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu writes about some of those changes as part of this week's edition of Inside the DoD Reporter's Notebook. Jared, it's been about 6 months since Terry Takei left as the Chief Information Officer at the Department of Defense. So
right.
It's been that long since since the agency has had a permanent CIO. But there were a number of folks who wondered if the reason for that was because of these potential changes in the NDAA. What are those changes, and how will they affect the way the org chart looks inside OSD?
It's hard to know, and I don't think anyone assumed that the org chart changes that Congress is contemplating would ultimately come to pass. It now looks like they probably will. Let's start with the internal changes, though, if you don't mind. There are a couple
yes.
changes. One of them is legislative, and one of them is internal. And just to start with the internal one, the Deputy Defense Secretary, Bob Work, just signed off on a new directive that's intended to help clarify the role of the DoD CIO as it is right now, especially in the context of everything that DoD is doing with the buildup of its cyber forces. We can get to that in just a second. But one of the other fairly important things in that internal directive is that it does seem to make clear that the DoD CIO is not just the internal advisor to the Secretary of Defense about IT stuff and kind of the convener of all the military services, all of whom have their own CIOs and their own legal authorities. It makes clear, probably for the first time on paper, that the DoD CIO really is, no kidding, in charge of getting rid of duplicate of IT between the military departments. And that's something DoD itself has said over and over again that it wants to do, but I'm not sure there's ever been a single enforcer that can make that happen. We'll see if this directive makes a significant difference in that area, and we'll have to see how the current acting CIO, Terry Halverson, exercises that. And then secondly, as I mentioned, it does try to deal with the fuzzy line between the CIO function and the cyber missions DoD is still trying to map its way through. Mr. Halverson, who, again, is the acting CIO, talked with us briefly about that earlier today. He says the directive does set some clearer lanes in the road.
Obviously, as we look at CIO and cyber, there are some things that are overlap on that, and there are some things that aren't. So this is, in effect, along with all the other things that DoD is doing, to clarify what CIO's role, to clarify what the principal cyber advisor's role is, what is the CIO's relationship to the operational commander, the cyber PSA. And I think it did that very well. Some of the specific things it did, it now made me the co-chair, along with DCMO, of the Defense Business Council. That, I think, is a big movement forward because they do have to work together. It clarified for the operational commander, the CIO, I don't have operational responsibility for cyber offensive or defensive missions. I set some policy guidelines, but we shouldn't have operational authority for that.
And Francis, you heard him mention the link up between the DoD CIO and the Deputy Chief Management Officer, and that's probably a good jumping off point to talk about the legislative part of what we're talking about. The House and Senate Armed Services Committees have reached an agreement, as we've been talking about all week, on the Defense Authorization Bill for 2015. The House passed that bill yesterday, and assuming the Senate does too and the President signs it, the CIO and the DCMO will merge into one position, and a very high-level position called the Undersecretary of Defense for Business Management and Information. That new job would be actually the number three position in the Pentagon, just below the Defense Secretary and the Deputy Secretary. Halverson didn't want to talk about that specific provision or anything else in the NDAA since it's not law yet, obviously, but he's very clear about the fact that the CIO and the DCMO ought to have a very, very close and tight working relationship. Those two offices have already been moving in that direction, sort of without the direction of Congress in a lot of ways.
Federal News Radio's Jared Serbu is going inside the reporter's notebook. That provision in the National Defense Authorization Act has fascinated me since we first learned about it. I'm going to say, what, a year and a half or 2 years ago that they've been trying to stick this in someplace. And that concept of the CIO and the DCMO being the same job and being the same person overseeing both of those, I'm going to really follow with great interest what happens with that if this does indeed become law, Jared, because they're not positions I guess I would intuitively put together. I'm not suggesting that they're not that it's not a good fit. It's just not something that I would have foreseen happening. Those two jobs go together.
Well, and it's a really unique situation within DOD. And up until now, I think it's those two offices have operated very independently from each other. What you have right now, I think, is two personalities: Dave Tillotson, the acting DCMO, and Terry Halverson, the acting CIO, who have come together and said, "You know what? Our business operations, you know, our two missions actually intersect pretty well." So the CIO is in charge of, you know, making sure that all the IT systems work together, overseeing all the business systems. The DCMO is in charge of overseeing all of, not necessarily managing all the business processes, but having the ultimate oversight role over all of the business processes. And those two people in this case have come together and said, you know what, our two roles actually make a lot of sense together. So they're basically doing, I think, what Congress envisioned this alignment coming together toward. And instead of having that dependent on personalities in the future, I think the hope is among members on Capitol Hill that we're going to institutionalize this rather than having it depend on who's holding those offices right now, or even the two people who are acting in those offices right now.
Another story that you have in the notebook this week is another one that I've been following with great interest for a while. The Pentagon is getting one step closer, it appears, to actually being auditable. It's never happened in history before. The last deadline was 2011. 2017 is the next for a full audit.
Right.
And the next step in this is what, as you're reporting this week, Jared?
Yeah, and you're right. This is a very, very long saga I've been covering ever since I started covering the Defense Department. But this is a positive sign, I think. So the Pentagon has already said that they think they can get the military departments to pass this limited audit in 2015. But now they are putting their money where their mouth is. They've awarded three contracts this week. All told, it's $37 million when you put them all together, and that's no small chunk of change during sequestration. They could very well spend that money elsewhere in their operations and maintenance accounts during this tough budget time if they wanted to continue to slough this stuff off. But what they're basically doing is they're saying, we think that we finally got our books in a place where we can pass what's called an audit of the statement of budget, a schedule of budgetary assessments, which is a step back from what they were originally intending to do in 2014, which was the schedule of budgetary resources. What it basically is a full accounting that you can prove to outside auditors on paper of all of the appropriated money that we got from Congress, and then every single dollar that went out the door from those appropriated funds. So there were three contracts that went out, one to Ernst & Young for the Air Force, one to Cotton & Company for the Navy, one to KPMG for the Army, again, for a total of $37 million. It does not say necessarily that DOD is going to pass that legislative deadline of getting all of its books in order by 2017, but it is a significant step. The Marine Corps led the way on this. They were the first ones to prove that this could be done within a military organization. They got a positive audit on their schedule of budgetary activity for 2012, and they think that they've basically proven the way forward to do this in the military. The DOD says once you get that basic fundamental building block, this SBA audit in place, you've basically got about 90% of all of your money under audit. And once you do that, that's the hard part. You can then build from there. They think once they get this done, you can then move on and do the other 10%, which includes a lot of stuff that's not traditionally thought of as, you know, budget stuff. It includes, you know, making sure that you've got a full and documentable accounting of all your spare parts, all of your aircraft, all of your, you know, all of your ships, and where exactly all of that stuff is around the world. There's a lot that goes into a full accounting of a general fund budget statement, but this is a significant part of it. And I think, again, by the fact that DOD has, you know, put contracts forward to try and put those to the scrutiny of independent auditors, they think they can actually do it with all three military departments.
Another item you have in the notebook this weekend, we just have a couple of minutes left, Jared, is about another issue that has been ongoing. You call it, quite diplomatically, I think, persistent defense industry complaints. I would call it a word that starts with a B and ends with the word itching, but The concept of lowest price technically acceptable. You're reporting somebody at the Pentagon is finally going to pay attention to the suggestions that have been made about LPTA.
Your point is right on. Industry hates LPTA. They complain about it constantly. Whenever we bring it up to DoD officials, they say, look, the policy is you're only supposed to use LPTA when you can clearly define your requirements and you don't want anything above the threshold that you've defined in the contract. Industry says that's not actually what happens. Everything is being awarded on the lowest price, whether it's actually defined as LPTA in the contract. That's what ends up happening. So it looks like the Pentagon is actually going to try and go out and get some good data about how it's actually using LPTA. Randall Culpepper, who's the Air Force's program executive officer for service contracting, talked about this yesterday at an AFSEA conference out in Tyson's Corner. He said that Frank Kendall, the undersecretary for acquisition, logistics, and technology, has tasked him to go out and throughout the Department of Defense and look at and try and gather data on exactly how LPTA is being used. For a couple of reasons. One is because the Air Force has had both positive and negative experiences with LPTA. Just to talk about one of the negative experiences that he highlighted, there are a lot of cases in which it's awarded LPTA contracts, and it's turned out that the lowest price hasn't actually turned out to be technically acceptable because it gave it to the lowest price vendor, and it turned out that vendor had underbid the thing so much that it couldn't actually hire the people that it needed to perform. So they had to go back and try and fix things after the fact. So in a sort of paradoxical way, as I wrote about in the notebook this week, it's now defining technically acceptable in a way that includes the price that the vendor brings to the government. So if you bring a price that's so crazily unrealistic that there's no way that you're going to be able to find the talent that the government needs out in industry, the government will now say, that might not be technically acceptable. So that's a new wrinkle to LPTA. The actual study that is going to come out of this will probably be a part of the overall Better Buying Power 3.0 effort, and we may see some actual data out of this that can tell us whether industry's complaints are valid or whether DOD is right about the fact that this is just a few isolated cases that have been blown up.
That's a fascinating development, because I can see some folks who might think the next step after that is the Defense Department telling industry, if they have that much pricing information up front, telling industry how much they're going to be willing to pay up front. And I can imagine a lot of people will be more unhappy about that than they are about LPTA. It's a great item inside the reporter's notebook. Jared, thanks very much for coming on, as always, my friend.
Thank you, sir.